A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Most goal-setting advice starts with the wrong premise. It assumes the problem is that you don't know what you want, when the actual problem for a lot of people is that you want too many things at once, and the list itself becomes the source of dread. Daniel wrote in with a whole thing about this, and the timing is, let's say, pointed. He says goal tracking as a phrase makes him nervous. It triggers what he calls the ADHD organization response, that immediate sense of, this is going to be hard for me specifically. But he's also noticed that therapy can drift when there's no clear target, and he wants a way to capture and separate two very different kinds of goals. Time-limited ones, the acute stuff, and lifelong aspirational ones, the compass bearings, like not caring too much about what other people think. His intuition is that a common failure mode is trying to tackle everything at once, walking into an intake session with a laundry list, and then diluting the whole effort. And he's asking, if you wanted to take an inventory of your soul, a bit cheesy in his words, and come up with an ordered list of current challenges and long-term aspirations, how do you do that well without the spreadsheet dread?
The spreadsheet dread is the tell. It's not the goals that scare people, it's the apparatus. The habit tracker with the green check marks, the daily planner with the empty boxes, the app that sends you a notification at 9 p.m. asking if you journaled. That machinery is built for a very specific kind of brain, and it punishes everyone else.
Right. And Daniel's question is really two questions bolted together. One is taxonomic. How do you tell a time-limited goal from a lifelong one? The other is procedural. How do you actually take the inventory without spiraling? And they're connected because most tracking systems collapse the two categories and then wonder why nothing works.
Let's start with the taxonomy because it's cleaner than people think. A time-limited goal is something you could put a date on and know whether it happened. Reduce panic attacks from 3 a week to 1 a week in 3 months. Finish the course of exposure therapy by December. Get through a family wedding without a full shutdown. These are specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-bound. The whole SMART framework was built for this category. They live in the near future, weeks to months out.
And the lifelong aspirational ones aren't SMART-able. You can't put a deadline on living authentically. If you say, I'll stop caring what others think by December, you've already failed because you've turned a value into a task. Values don't complete. They orient.
That's the distinction. A time-limited goal is a destination with a finish line. An aspirational goal is a compass bearing. You never arrive at north. You just use it to check whether you're walking in the right direction. And when you apply time-limited tools to a compass bearing, weekly check-ins, progress bars, percentage complete, you create a permanent sense of failure because there's no completion event. You're at 40% of not caring what people think. What does that even mean?
40% is also the point where the app tells you you're behind and you should feel bad. Which brings us to the ADHD angle. Because Daniel flagged it directly, the anxiety isn't a character flaw, it's neurological. ADHD brains discount delayed rewards more steeply than neurotypical ones. A goal that pays off in 6 months doesn't feel real. The dopamine system doesn't register it as salient. So when a tracking system asks you to care about something abstract and far away, it's asking a brain to do the thing it's worst at, and then it shames you for failing.
And that shame spiral is the actual harm. It's not that the tracking fails, it's that the tracking becomes evidence of your inadequacy. Every missed day is a data point in a case against yourself. The tool that was supposed to help becomes the prosecution.
So the first move is to stop using one tool for both categories. Time-limited goals get the SMART treatment. Aspirational goals get something more like values, clarification, which is what acceptance and commitment therapy does. ACT doesn't ask you to achieve your values. It asks you to act in their direction. The question isn't, how do I become someone who doesn't care what others think? The question is, what would I do differently this week if I cared less?
And that's the bridge Daniel was asking about. The gulf between recognizing a lifelong goal and actually living it, you close it with micro-experiments. Not, I'll stop caring what people think, but I'll wear the outfit I like but think is too bold, and I'll notice what happens. I'll speak up in one meeting without apologizing first. I'll say no to one social invitation without giving a 3-paragraph explanation. Each of those is a time-limited action in service of an aspirational direction. The experiment is finishable. The value is not.
And the tracking for that isn't a checklist of success or failure. It's a log of what it felt like. Did the world end when you wore the bold outfit? Did the meeting collapse when you didn't apologize? The data you're collecting is experiential, not performative.
Which gets us to the therapy-specific failure pattern Daniel identified. Intake sessions become a dump. Every life problem gets mentioned in 45 minutes, and then the therapist and client try to address all of them at once. The result is diluted focus and no measurable progress on anything. There's a meta-analysis on personalized treatment goals that found when clients and therapists co-create a small number of specific goals, outcomes improve significantly. But the key is small number, not 12 goals, one or two.
The research on goal setting backs this up from the productivity side too. Focusing on a single goal at a time increases the likelihood of achievement compared to spreading effort across multiple goals. The brain can't track 6 priorities. It can track one, maybe two if one of them is small.
So, the inventory process Daniel's asking about, the soul inventory, has to be built around that constraint. You're not making a list of everything you want to fix. You're making a list, and then you're doing triage.
Let's walk the actual process. Step one is the brain dump. Write down every challenge and every aspiration without judgment. Acute stuff, chronic stuff, the panic attacks, the confidence, the relationship friction, the not caring what people think, all of it. The point of this step is to get it out of your head and onto paper, because the ADHD brain holds things in working memory and treats every unrecorded item as an active emergency. Externalizing it, the first act of self-compassion.
Step two is categorization. Go through the list and mark each item as either acute or chronic. Acute means time-limited, needs immediate attention, has a finish line. Chronic means aspirational, values-based, directional. The panic attacks are acute. The desire to be more confident is chronic. The fight with your spouse about the dishes is acute. The pattern of avoiding conflict is chronic.
And here's the thing. Most people will have a mix, and the mix is useful information. If your list is all acute, you're in crisis management mode and the aspirational stuff can wait. If it's all chronic, you might be avoiding the acute thing that's actually hurting you right now.
Step three is where the ordering happens. For each acute item, ask, what's the smallest version of this I could tackle in 30 days? Not, fix my anxiety, but, have 2 panic attacks instead of 3 this month, or, go to the grocery store alone twice. For each chronic item, ask, what would a good week look like if I were living this value? Not, be confident, but, I'd volunteer one idea in a meeting, or I'd stop rehearsing conversations before they happen.
Then step four is the one thing rule. Pick one acute goal and one aspirational goal. That's it. Everything else goes on a parking lot list that you're explicitly not working on right now. And this isn't ignoring the rest. It's giving your brain a chance to actually see progress. Progress builds momentum, and momentum reduces the shame that comes from scattered effort.
The parking lot list is important for ADHD specifically. It's not a graveyard, it's a holding pen. The items are still there, they're written down, they won't be forgotten. But they're not active. And that reduces the cognitive load of feeling like you should be working on everything simultaneously.
Daniel's example is a clean illustration. Not caring what others think is chronic. It's a value. You can't finish it, but you can set a time-limited sub-goal, like practicing saying no to one social invitation per week without over-explaining. That's a 30-day experiment. At the end of 30 days, you look at the log and ask, what did I learn about what happens when I say no? The value didn't complete, but you moved in its direction, and you have evidence.
And the evidence is the antidote to the anxiety. The anxiety comes from the fear of failure, but the fear is based on a prediction. I'll say no and the person will hate me. The experiment tests the prediction. Most of the time, the prediction is wrong. The person says, okay, no problem. And now you have a data point that contradicts the fear.
The therapy version of this is the panic attack client. They come in with acute panic attacks and a chronic desire to be more confident. If you try to tackle both at once, you're doing exposure work and simultaneously asking them to reframe their entire self-concept. That's overwhelming. Instead, focus on the panic attacks first, because they're acute and they're blocking everything else. Use the confidence value to guide how you approach that work. The confidence goal tells you what direction to move, but the panic attacks tell you what to do this week.
And a good therapist should be doing this with you, co-creating goals, not just listening. If therapy feels open-ended, it's okay to say, "Can we set a specific goal for the next few sessions?" That's not a lack of trust. That's a collaborative therapeutic alliance. The research says the kind of explicit goal setting actually enhances the alliance. It doesn't undermine it.
The misconception is that therapy should be exploratory forever, but exploration without direction is just wandering. The goals are the lighthouse. They don't have to be rigid. They can change, but they give you something to steer by.
And the inventory itself should be a recurring practice, not a one-time exercise. Every 3 to 6 months, revisit the list. Life changes, and so do your goals. The acute item from March might be resolved by September, or it might have morphed into something else. The aspirational value might have shifted. Keeping the list alive prevents it from becoming stale and keeps it aligned with what's actually true now.
The ADHD-friendly tweak on the tracking side is to abandon daily check-ins entirely. Weekly review. 3 questions. What worked this week? What didn't? What's one tiny adjustment for next week? That's it. No daily streaks. No green check marks. No 9 p.m. notifications. The weekly cadence works with the ADHD need for novelty and flexibility instead of against it.
The weekly review is also where you update the parking lot. Something that was parked might become urgent. Something that was urgent might resolve on its own. The list is a living document, not a static contract.
And this is the deeper insight that most goal tracking advice misses. The tracking isn't about control, it's about self-compassion. The anxiety comes from a fear of failure, but the real failure isn't having a direction at all. A goal list is a map, not a report card. You don't get graded on it. You use it to find your way.
The report card framing is the poison. It's what turns a useful tool into a shame engine, and it's what makes Daniel's nervousness completely rational. He's not bad at goal tracking. He's been handed tools that were designed to grade him, and his brain knows that a grade is coming, and it's opting out.
So, the framework in summary is, brain dump everything, categorize acute versus chronic, shrink the acute items to 30-day versions, translate the chronic items into good week questions, pick one of each, and review weekly with the 3 questions. That's the whole method. It fits on an index card.
And the index card is the point. The simpler the tool, the less likely it's to become the thing you're managing instead of the thing that's managing you.
Daniel also asked about the ordered list specifically. How do you rank the items once you've categorized them? And I think the ranking criteria are urgency and leverage. Urgency is, how much is this costing me right now? Leverage is, which one, if I solved it, would make the others easier? The panic attacks are high urgency and high leverage. They're costing you daily, and solving them would reduce the anxiety that's probably feeding the relationship conflict and the procrastination. So, they go to the top.
The relationship conflict might be high urgency but lower leverage, because solving it wouldn't necessarily touch the anxiety. The procrastination might be lower urgency but very high leverage, because solving it would free up time and reduce the self-criticism that feeds everything else. The ranking is a judgment call, but the 2 criteria keep it from being arbitrary.
And the ranking is where a therapist earns their fee. They can see the leverage relationships that you can't because you're inside the system. You think the problem is the relationship, but the therapist sees that the relationship is a symptom of the anxiety, and the anxiety is a symptom of the self-criticism, and the self-criticism is the thing that actually needs to go on the acute list.
That's the triage model. Emergency medicine does this constantly. You don't treat the broken arm and the heart attack with equal urgency just because both are on the intake form. You stabilize the heart first, then set the arm. Therapy is the same. The intake dump is the intake form. The triage is the actual clinical work.
And the client who comes in with the dump isn't doing anything wrong. They're doing what the system asks. The failure is when the therapist doesn't triage. when everything goes on the treatment plan at once, and nothing gets the focused attention it needs.
The analysis found that the number of goals matters, not the comprehensiveness of the list, the small number, one or two goals, co-created, specific. That's the evidence-based practice, not 12 goals on a whiteboard.
So Daniel's instinct is correct. The failure pattern is trying to tackle too much at once. The fix is triage, not more willpower.
And the soul inventory, the cheesy phrase, is actually the right frame. An inventory is a count of what you have, not a judgment of what you lack. You're not making a list of your failures. You're making a list of what's in the warehouse. Some of it's acute, some of it's chronic, all of it's information.
The warehouse metaphor is good. You can't manage inventory you haven't counted. And the counting itself is neutral. You're not saying I'm a broken person because I have anxiety and I care too much what people think. You're saying, these are the items on the shelf right now. Which ones do I need to move this month?
And that neutrality is what makes the process survivable for an ADHD brain. The judgment is the anxiety trigger. The counting is just counting.
Let's talk about the bridge Daniel mentioned again, because it's the part that trips people up even after they've got the taxonomy. You recognize the lifelong goal. You can articulate it. You even believe it's worthwhile. But between recognition and living it, there's this vast gulf, and the gulf is made of habits, predictions, and old stories.
The old story is, I'm the kind of person who cares too much what others think. And the story feels like identity. It feels like a fact about yourself. But it's actually a prediction that's been reinforced by years of avoidance. You avoided the thing that scared you, so you never got the data that the thing wouldn't hurt you. The avoidance maintained the story.
The micro-experiment breaks the maintenance loop. You do the thing you've been avoiding, and you collect data. The data contradicts the story. Do that enough times, and the story starts to change. Not because you decided to change it, but because the evidence stops supporting it.
That's the behavioral mechanism. The cognitive reframe comes after the behavioral experiment, not before. You can't think your way out of caring what people think. You have to act your way out, one small experiment at a time.
And the tracking of that's not, did I succeed at not caring? It's, what did I do, and what happened? The log is a scientist's notebook, not a report card. You're collecting observations, not grades.
The outfit example is perfect for this. You wear the bold thing. You predict everyone will stare and judge. You go to the grocery store. Nobody stares. Or someone stares and then goes back to their shopping. Or someone compliments you. The prediction was wrong. The data point lands. The story weakens by one notch.
The notches accumulate. That's the bridge. It's not a leap. It's a series of small steps, each one producing evidence that the old story was a prediction, not a fact.
The therapy version of this is the client who says, I want to be more confident. The therapist doesn't say, great, be confident. The therapist says, what would a confident person do in this specific situation, and can we try doing that this week? The value gets translated into a behavior, and the behavior gets tested.
The test is time limited. 1 week, one situation, one observation. Then the next week, another one. The confidence goal never completes, but the behaviors accumulate, and after 6 months the client is doing things they couldn't do before, and the story has changed.
The ordered list comes back into play here, because the micro-experiments should come from the top of the list. The highest urgency, highest leverage item is the one that gets the experiments, not the 10th item, the first one.
If the first item is too big for a micro-experiment, you haven't shrunk it enough. The 30-day question is, what's the smallest version of this I could tackle? If the smallest version is still terrifying, you go smaller. One phone call instead of three. One sentence instead of a conversation. 1 minute of exposure instead of 10.
The shrink it until it's almost silly rule. If the step feels too small to matter, it's probably the right size. The ADHD brain needs a win it can actually achieve, and a win that small is achievable.
The win is the point, the momentum. One small win creates the conditions for the next small win. The list starts to feel like something you're doing, not something that's being done to you.
The agency shift is the therapeutic mechanism underneath all of this. When the list is a report card, you're passive. You're being graded. When the list is a map, you're active. You're navigating. And agency is the opposite of the shame spiral.
Daniel's question about doing the inventory well is really a question about doing it without triggering the spiral. And the answer is, keep it neutral, keep it small, keep it flexible. The brain dump is neutral. The categorization is neutral. The 30-day shrinkage is small. The weekly review is flexible. No part of the process demands perfection.
The weekly review specifically is the ADHD-friendly replacement for daily tracking. Three questions. What worked? What didn't? What's one tiny adjustment? That's a known technique for ADHD productivity because it reduces the pressure of daily consistency. Daily consistency is the thing ADHD brains can't do reliably. Weekly reflection is the thing they can do.
The adjustment piece is crucial. It's not, what did I fail at this week? It's, what's one tiny thing I'll do differently next week? The frame is forward-looking and experimental. You're tuning the system, not auditing the failure.
The tuning is where the self-compassion shows up. You're not beating yourself up for the week that didn't go well. You're saying, okay, that didn't work. What's the next iteration? The same way you'd debug a process, not the same way you'd scold a child.
The scolding is the default for a lot of people. The internal monologue that says, you missed 3 days, you're bad at this, give up. The weekly review replaces that with, the system missed 3 days, let's adjust the system. The problem is external to you. It's the process, not the person.
That's the deepest reframe. The goal list isn't a measure of your worth. It's a tool for navigating your life. When the tool breaks, you fix the tool. You don't conclude that you're broken.
The soul inventory, done this way, is an act of self-respect. You're saying, my life has challenges and aspirations, and they're worth taking seriously enough to write down and sort and prioritize. That's not cheesy. That's basic maintenance.
The cheese is in the phrase, not the practice. The practice is clinical. Triage, categorization, behavioral experiments, weekly review. These are evidence-based techniques. The soul part is just the acknowledgement that the inventory matters.
The inventory matters because the alternative is the fog. Therapy without goals feels like wandering. Life without goals feels like drifting. The list is the thing that turns vague suffering into actionable direction. Not because the list fixes anything by itself, but because it tells you where to point the effort.
The effort is finite. That's the thing people forget. You only have so much attention, so much energy, so much time in a week. The list is how you decide where to spend it. Without the list, you spend it on whatever's loudest, which is usually the thing that's been loudest for years and never gets quieter.
The loudest thing is often the chronic stuff, the lifelong worry about what people think. It's loud because it's always been loud. But it's not acute. It doesn't need a finish line. It needs a direction. The acute stuff, the panic attacks, the crisis, that's what needs the finish line. The triage is how you tell the difference.
The triage is how you stop the intake dump from becoming the treatment plan. You don't have to work on everything. You have to work on the right thing. The right thing is the one that's costing you the most right now, and the one that, if you moved it, would make the others easier.
The leverage point. The keystone habit. The one thing that unlocks the rest. That's what you put at the top of the list.
The list is ordered. Not because order is satisfying, but because order is how you know what to ignore. The bottom of the list isn't abandoned. It's parked. You'll get to it. But not this month. This month, you're doing the top item.
The parking lot is the ADHD-friendly version of saying no. You're not saying no to the 10th item. You're saying, not right now. And the not right now is written down, so it's not forgotten, so it's not nagging at the back of your mind as an open loop.
Open loops are the ADHD kryptonite. Every unrecorded task is a loop that runs in the background, consuming attention. The brain dump closes the loops. The parking lot keeps them closed. The weekly review reopens the ones that need reopening.
That's the whole system. Dump, categorize, shrink, prioritize, experiment, review. 6 steps. Index card size. No app required.
The app is the trap anyway. The app wants you to engage daily. The app wants streaks. The app wants to be the thing you're managing. The notebook doesn't want anything. It just sits there and holds your list.
The notebook also doesn't send passive-aggressive notifications, which is more than I can say for some of the goal-tracking software that was floating around in the early 2000s.
It was called GoalForge. Desktop application, $99, came on a CD in a cardboard sleeve. You put your goals in, and if you missed a day, it'd pop up a little box that said, your goals are waiting for you. The word waiting was in italics. I sold it for 3 weeks in 2003 before I quit. The company was called AspireSoft. They had a booth at a trade show in Hartford, and they hired me because I'd done sales for a vacuum cleaner distributor the year before. The pitch was, this software will hold you accountable. The reality was, this software will make you feel like you have a disappointed parent living in your taskbar. There was a woman, one of the early customers, she bought it for her New Year's resolutions. Lose weight, organize the garage, learn Spanish. She put all three in, and the app asked her to check in every single day. Missed a day, the pop-up. Missed 2 days, the pop-up got a little more pointed. By February, she called the support line, which was me, and said she'd stopped doing all three resolutions because the app made her feel like a failure every time she opened her computer. I told her to uninstall it. She said she'd paid $99. I said the $99 was the lesson. The app was built for people who already have the discipline to check in every day, and those people don't need the app. Everyone else gets the pop-up, and the pop-up is the product, and the product is shame. I still use a notebook. It's got more crossouts than check marks. That's the point. The list is a living thing, not a scorecard. You cross something out because it changed, not because you failed. You write something new because life moved. The notebook doesn't judge. It just holds the list. I look at it once a week, usually Sunday morning with coffee. 3 questions, same as you said. What worked? What didn't? What's one thing I'll change? Takes 10 minutes. Then I close it and go about my day. The goals are in the notebook, not in my head, which means they're not running in the background. The software people never understood that. They thought the daily check-in was the feature. The daily check-in is the bug. It keeps the goal in your head all day, every day, and the head is the worst place to keep a goal.
The head is where the goal turns into a judgment. The notebook is where it stays a plan.
The weekly rhythm is what makes it sustainable. Daily is too frequent, monthly is too sparse. Weekly is the cadence where you can actually see change without obsessing over it.
The crossouts are interesting. A crossout in a notebook isn't a failure, it's a decision. You looked at the item and said, this doesn't belong anymore. That's triage in action. The list is doing its job.
The scorecard model doesn't allow for crossouts. It only allows for check marks and empty boxes. The crossout is the third option, and it's the one that makes the list honest.
The inventory process, the whole thing, is really a practice of honesty. Honest about what's acute and what's chronic. Honest about what you can actually do in 30 days. Honest about what you're parking and what you're prioritizing. The honesty is uncomfortable, but it's less uncomfortable than the fog.
The fog is the alternative. Open-ended therapy, open-ended life, no direction, no triage, just the loudest thing winning every week. The list is how you turn the volume down on the loud thing and focus on the important thing.
The important thing for Daniel, based on what he wrote, is the not caring what others think. That's the chronic item. The acute items he didn't specify, but the process works the same. Dump everything. Categorize. Find the one acute thing that's costing him the most right now, and the one chronic thing that's been loudest for the longest. That's his top two.
The aspirational one gets the micro-experiment treatment. Not stop caring what people think by December, but this week I'll do one thing I'd normally avoid for fear of judgment, and I'll write down what actually happened. The log is the evidence. The evidence is the bridge.
The bridge from recognizing the goal to living, it's built out of those weekly experiments. Each one is a plank. You don't cross the gulf in one leap. You lay planks until you're on the other side, and then you look back and realize you've been walking on solid ground for a while.
The solid ground is the new story. The old story was, I care too much what people think. The new story is, I did the thing, and the world didn't end, and I have the log to prove it. The new story is built on data, not on fear.
That's the whole point of the tracking. To gather the data that lets you rewrite the story. The list is a research instrument. The experiments are the methodology. The weekly review is the analysis. And the soul inventory is just the first pass at figuring out what questions are worth asking.
The questions worth asking are the ones at the top of the list. The ones that are costing you the most and unlocking the most. Everything else is parked. And the parking lot is full, and that's fine because you're not working on everything. You're working on the one thing that matters this month.
Next month, the list will look different. Something will be crossed out. Something new will be added. The inventory is alive. It's not a document you create once and laminate. It's a practice you return to every 3 to 6 months or every Sunday morning with coffee, depending on how deep you want to go.
The depth is up to you. The framework is the same. Dump, categorize, shrink, prioritize, experiment, review. The soul part is just showing up to do it.
Showing up is the thing the apps can't do for you. They can remind you to show up, but the reminder is the problem. The showing up has to come from you, on your own terms, at your own pace.
The pace is the sloth part, I suppose. Slow and steady, one small step. One micro-experiment, one weekly review. The list doesn't care how fast you go, it just cares that you're going.
The going is the goal. The arrival is a myth for the aspirational stuff, and for the acute stuff, the arrival is just the point where you pick the next thing off the parking lot. The list never empties. That's not a failure. That's a life.
A life with direction. That's what Daniel's asking for, underneath the taxonomy and the process. Direction. Clarity about what he's actually in the room for. The list is how you get it.
The list is how you keep it. When the fog rolls back in and the loud thing starts yelling again, you look at the list. You remember what you decided. You do the next small thing. The fog doesn't lift all at once, but you're moving through it.
The question we opened with, how do you know when a goal is done versus when you're avoiding it? Maybe the answer is that the acute goals are the only ones that ever finish. The aspirational ones just keep orienting you. And the avoidance shows up as the gap between what you said you'd do this week and what you actually did. The gap is information, not judgment. The weekly review is where you read it.
The future of all this, the AI angle, is interesting. The apps are getting smarter. They can already adapt to your patterns. The question is whether they'll adapt to your brain's actual needs, the flexibility, the novelty, the forgiveness, or whether they'll just get better at sending the pop-up. The pop-up with the italics.
The pop-up that says your goals are waiting for you. The future is either a goal coach that learned your rhythms, or a more sophisticated shame engine. The difference is whether the tool treats you as the navigator or the problem.
The navigator is the right frame. The list is the map. The experiments are the route. The weekly review is the checkpoint. And the whole thing exists to serve the navigator, not to grade them.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running and for the notebook wisdom.
If you want to send us your own weird prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.